Hey, it's Brian Cook, your host here. Wanted to let you know we now have t-shirts. Would you like to support the podcast? Have you noticed that I can't get a sponsor because this show's too filthy? Hey, it'd be great if some people ordered shirts. They're great looking shirts. Go to estoymerchandise.com, E-S-T-O-Y merchandise.com. You'll find competitive erotic fanfiction on the right-hand side. Click on that and you can order shirts. There's men's and women's sizes. It's a great design by my buddy Mark Palm in Seattle. He does all of our amazing poster art. Please support the podcast. It would help us out a ton. That's estoymerchandise.com. E-S-T-O-Y merchandise.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 149 of the Competitive Erotic Fanfiction Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Cook, and you've found the internet's number one most trusted source for Muppet boners and horny loners. Upcoming shows include November 15th at the Virgil in Los Angeles, December 26th at Great Scott in Boston, December 28th at Union Hall in Brooklyn. And today's show was recorded at the Virgil on October 18th, 2015, featuring John Toll, Steve Young, Suna Bilstead, and Mo Welch, reading pieces they wrote in advance based upon topics of their choosing. Enjoy.
Please welcome your first round one competitor who will be reading a prepared piece. Mr. Is there a bathroom up there? Yes, there is. Chris Charpentier, your first round one competitor, John Toll, ladies and gentlemen. John Toll!
There's one.
Not happy about this either.
It's not a good look, is it?
No,
not at all. It really, son of a bitch. They don't make these in metal. Come, she silently screamed at him through the teeth of her worst effort. It was deep in her heart where she wished her life sentence would be commuted by the kicked over chair of her choosing. Her tongue swirling in mock delight, flicking, displaying, swallowing, while naming each obese sadpole as they made their way into the death chasm her throat had become. Motherhood would have to wait another day. He knew he was useless, lying there watching her hatred in grimace form through the limited reflection of their sliding glass door, but it was the only way he was able to watch her pretend to give a shit. A few minutes and a trouser wipe later, he trudged through the gray snow-lined streets of Boston. What is love really, other than two biological entities deciding that they've mentally evolved enough to accept that they've just given up trying to do better? Love was a death sentence in life. It just never gets better. It's just the mundane repetition of regret. He grabbed the door and he took a deep breath. Norm, the bar yelled. What's going down, Norm? Woody asked as he poured another brick in Norm's path to foot removal. From what I can see or hear, Diane and Rebecca going down on Sam. Good God, right under my own nose? What a trollop! Fraser gasped as the gang ran back to the pool table. Sensing the crowd building, Sammy bent Diane over the pool table while Rebecca read selected passages of James Joyce through the unzipped ear hole in Diane's leather cowl. I'm so alone. Dane! Diane writhed about, grasping at the pool table's felt, her knees buckling as Mayday gave her the high hard one. Her nails found their grip, and she came with a force that knocked Sam back with a stream of cum that gurgled like Ned Clampett's backyard. Now, technically, when a woman squirts, she's actually peeing. Shut up, Cliff, the room roared. She ripped back the felt and immediately retched as she escaped from atop the pool table. Of all the things you've done and you've been capable of, this is a new low, Sam Malone, even for you. Diane, look, I can explain. The crowd gathered, peering through its ripped felt, revealing the mummified corpse of their beloved coach, Ernie Pantuso. You know, the Egyptians and early Mesopotamians used to mummify. Shut up, Cliff, the room yelled. Diane, I can explain. We had a wake, and that night I wanted to drink, so I sat with the body. And I thought about what Coach had meant to all of us, and we watched the Sox together. And I held his hand, and that night they won, and I stayed sober. In fact, they went on a 3-week tear, and every night I would hold his hand, and we would win. Eventually, I knew I had to do something, so I preserved Coach's body in a refrigerated fish tank and hid it under the pool table because, let's be honest, nobody ever really uses it. I did, however, Sam reached into his pocket and pulled out Coach's mummified cock. It was leathery, wet, and intense, like if John Boehner ran the mine, like if John Boehner ran the mine full of child slaves in Temple of Doom. The crowd let out a gasp. I knew I'd been smelling Slim Jim since I started working here, Woody added. Rebecca was mortified at the scene, but secretly wondered how many Weight Watchers points a mummified cock was. There was rustling deeper in a tank, and a man stood up, clothed in a suit and a bloody burlap bag over his head. Norm ripped the bag off. Embattled NFL commissioner and the architect behind the Deflategate scandal scumbag Roger Goodell? This is personal at this point, all right? I want you guys to know that. Sam leaned in. You know, you'd be surprised who answers Craigslist ads about wanting to see a lucky dead body. Cliff stepped forward. You know, based on my research, it would appear the NFL and ESPN were aware of the Ray Rice elevator beating the night it happened, so they colluded allegedly to cover up the crime with this kangaroo court of a decision to distract the public and undermine the legacy and the talent of the greatest quarterback of all time, the chiseled perfection that is Tom Brady. The room nodded. We all know Cliff. Sam added. He admitted that right to us before he cut out his tongue. Now bend him over and give me a football. This ends right here. Sam thrusted the football deep into Goodell's stained ass cheeks, which were way too tight to take it all in. It's episiotomy time! Sam screamed like a bad Marvel character pitch. It's not working, I need a knife. Carla held up one lone ice skate. This was the only thing they found after the Zamboni killed my Eddie, and I've been saving it for the right moment. Mayday was a surgeon with that skate. Years of sobriety had given him a steady hand. The group surveyed the gaping cavity as Mayday lined up the football for insertion. Frazier leaned in. Laces out, Sam. I believe I saw that in a movie about a jovial detective with a certain propensity for pets. Cliff was in between thrusts, forcing his swollen manhood intermittently into the eye holes of Goodell. You know, the average ball holds 13 PSI. We'll probably need 20 to explode this asshole. You're right, Cliff. And they ran an air horse into the ball. They ran an air horse into the ball and stood back. Goodell split open and bled like Buffalo Sabres goalie Clint Malarchuk if he went for Halloween as the runner-up shark in Jaws. That's really inside, I'm sorry. Seconds later, the body exploded and the room was caked in bloody scumbag. The gang retreated to the bar to knock back a cold one while Frazier mopped up the remnants and threw them back in the fish tank. Norm nursed his beer and surveyed the bar. Not only was he finally home, but he was in the place where not only where everybody knows your name, but he had found true love. And he had found the truth moving on, no matter what life threw him. He would never again look at the tank as half empty. I'm John Toll. God bless.
John Toll. Thanks, buddy. Keeping up, your next competitor, Mo Welch.
Sure.
Oh, ever the perfectionist. Mo thinks she's on TV.
Okay, I think I'll sit too. All right, let me know if this goes long. So it's getting pretty aged, you know. All right, man. This is a true story about me. It was Good Friday of all days. The sun was starting to set as I walked into the Walmart on 200 Walmart Way in Moorhead, Kentucky. I was on spring break in 2003, and I was in my first year at college at Western Kentucky University. I needed a new futon. My old one reminded me of my ex-girlfriend. It's where we started kissing so we could practice being good kissers for boys. And eventually started scissoring, so we would be good scissoring for boys. By April 03, I was full-blown lesbo, and I was open to love and love and love's naughty cousin, lust. after I found out the futons were sold out, I decided I might as well make the best of my time at Walmart and pick up some 3 packs of underwear and lemon-lime Gatorade. I've always been bad at picking out underwear. Call me old-fashioned, but I always like when my mom picked them out for me. Anyways, I grabbed a pair of high-waisted undies, and I saw a woman shaking her head ever so slightly out of the corner of my eye. I looked at her and lost my breath. And the lemon-lime Gatorade I'd illegally opened in aisle 56. She just giggled and tossed me a pair of low-rise Hanes to soak up the raid. She was the most beautiful thing that I'd ever seen, with her long brown hair, long FLDS-style dress, and transition lenses. I introduced myself. Hey, I'm Mo. Nice to meet you, Mo. I'm Cam Davis. Yes, the Kim Davis. In 2015, Kim Davis gained international attention after defying a federal court order requiring that she issue a marriage license, which she refused to. Kim Davis, short for Kimberly, huh? Perfection. And what are you doing all by yourself at a Walmart on Friday night? Buying turtlenecks, she said, with her seductive southern accent. She walked by me, and the smell of her cucumber melon suave shampoo and conditioner lingered in my nostrils for the duration of my shopping experience. Honestly, just between us, I knew from that moment that it was on. Before I left the Walmart, I walked up to Kim Davis, now at the checkout, twirling her little sideburns while her 54 turtlenecks were being scanned. I handed her my number, and she shoved it into her hair bump. I left, and for the first time, prayed to God. I asked him to please, please, please have Kim Davis call me that night. Luckily, my prayers were answered, and I didn't have to wait long. Kim Davis called that night. She said my figure made her soak through her sister wife dress. She wanted me to come over soon because her third husband would be home soon. I pulled up to her house. It had no foundation. A trailer simply driven onto property without the thought of a tornado shelter. Kind of irresponsible. I knocked on the door of Kim Davis, and she was standing there wearing only her nightie over a sheer turtleneck. Not to be crass, but I could have female ejaculated right there. She gently opened her rusty screen door and let me in. I ain't got no fancy Gatorade like you like, but I can offer you some day-old 2% milk, Kim Davis said. I'm good, thanks. I was undiagnosed lactose intolerant at the time. Kim Davis looked amazing. She didn't have a bra on and her nipples were poking out of her nightie, kind of like a whack-a-mole. You lack foreplay, Mo? Hell yeah. Well, sit down on that double recliner right there. She sat next to me and turned on the TV. She asked if it was okay if we watched her DVD box set of Seventh Heaven to warm up for our sex. Kim Davis started to rub my leg after she got excited by watching Seventh Heaven's Reverend Eric kiss his wife on the cheek. This was before he was a convicted sex offender, so I got turned on as well. 2 DVDs later, and Kim Davis was ready to take this to the next level. And I'll admit it, I was too. Kim Davis walked me to her bedroom. It looked like Christmas took a shit on her room. Like a special episode of Hoarders. Kim Davis then laid me down on her dirty twin, protecting my head like a newborn. The life-size crucifix illuminated her face as she whispered, "Take my turtleneck nightie off with your teeth." It took a while because the turtleneck is tight, and my teeth are only so strong. But alas, her naked body lay below me. Even though I was ready to start touching her breasts with my tongue, Kim Davis asked if I would crack her back first. I did. I was hoping Kim Davis had toys for us to experiment, but she said that Walmart sells guns and ammo, but no strap-ons. Fair enough. She had the largest bush I've seen to date. It was blonde. Kim Davis insisted I call it the Garden of Eden. But soon, it would become the Garden of Eaton. Before my tongue entered her garden, Kim Davis put on her favorite cassette to set the mood for my sex. Be Still My Soul, the Ultimate Hymns Collection. It wasn't turning me on, but she was all wet about it. She rolled around like a cat in heat, and I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting Kim Davis to have a tramp stamp of a nativity scene, but she did. That's what I liked most about her, her originality. Kim Davis insisted on yelling out all of her sins while I licked her pussy clean. I say that literally because it was quite dirty. I couldn't hear most of her sins except that Kim Davis yelled that she scissored Michelle Duggar 25 years ago, but they promised to keep that secret in their hair forever. Right as she was about to come, she told me to come up and to look at her. Took a lot of convincing, but Kim Davis let me remove her transition lenses so I could look deeply into her blue eyes. Our eyes were locked. Our bodies were pulsating. She said the only way for her to come is if a home video of her being baptized in a kiddie swimming pool at 40 was playing in the background. She came so hard. She yelled, "God is real! God is real!" and threw up her hands into the air and cried. She said she was a fair lover and wanted to go down on me now. I thought that was pretty selfless. She had some tricks up her sleeve. Kim Davis was spelling out the alphabet with her tongue while going down on me, but she admittedly forgot a couple of vowels. I said it was okay because the public school system is pretty shitty in middle America, so that makes sense. She had a good rhythm, and after about 15 minutes, I screamed, "Oh God, yes!" When Kim Davis heard that, when she was going down on me, she stopped until I apologized for taking the Lord's name in vain. That was a bummer. But I was so turned on, it barely mattered. Before she could even touch me again, I came while looking directly into her transition lenses. She had put them back on. Everything after that was a blur, because her husband came home and threw me out of the house. I managed to grab a snow globe and a rosary to put in my memory box, but I never did see Kimberly again. Word is she started hating gays. But I think we all know that Kim Davis is just another homophobic, beautiful, sexual lesbian. Come home, Kim Davis.
Well, Welch. Thanks, Mel. Giving over to Mr. Steve Young. London, 2012. Ryan Lochte turned the corner of the Olympic Stadium hallway feeling like a red-hot American winning machine. He just competed in his last event and glided past people snapping his picture, high-fiving him. Winning this big was such an aphrodisiac for him. He could tell he was starting to cast a telltale bulge in his racing suit. He pulled his bathrobe closed, and the phone in his pocket sprang to life. It was a text from Michael Phelps. "I just broke the world record for Olympic gold medals. Now it's time to break the world record in bong hits." This was followed by 8 swimmer emojis and a stream of marijuana leaves. Ryan was about to text back something, but he paused. He wanted to seem up for it, but not too up for it. After tapping some stuff out and then deleting it, he replied, "Kay." Ryan was proud of himself for playing it cool. Phelps, he texted, "I bailed on the Olympic Village. That place was ghetto. I got a penthouse at the Shangri-La, so come on over." Ryan texted him back, "Cruel. K-R-O-O-L. It was a catchphrase he was trying to start. In his mind, it meant that something was beyond cool. Unfortunately, he never realized how similar it sounded to cruel. What with his education being a series of fragmented tutoring sessions and fleeting stints in the Lake Okeechobee, Florida public school system. But he was desperately trying to make a signature catchphrase happen. This was important. He had just signed a deal to star on his own e-reality show, What Would Ryan Lochte Do? He was still figuring out what he would do, but one thing he knew was that a cool catchphrase would really make it awesome. Phelps texted him, question mark? An hour later, Ryan knocked on the door to Michael's suite. Michael opened the door in his underwear and a backwards baseball hat. Hey, dude, he said. Hey, brah, Ryan said. He hoped it sounded casual. God, why was he so nervous? Their friendship was hard to define. Sometimes months, even years, would go by without them seeing each other, but Ryan was always aware of Michael. Michael was a competitive obsession, a goal, a necessity, a long, tall merman he could never go for any length of time without thinking about. Then they would go from being competitors to teammates in the relays. When they high-fived after crushing it in Beijing, an electric charge shot down from their clasped hands to Ryan's groin. Ryan surveyed the penthouse. They were 52 stories high, and it felt like they were in a cloud. It was fancy, even classier than Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, Ryan thought. Hey, dude, you hit this first, Phelps said, handing Ryan a big glass bong. Ryan wasn't much of a pot smoker, but he was up for anything Michael suggested. They sat down next to each other on the bed. Michael handed him a lighter. Dude, I'm bad with lighters. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'll take care of it, brah. Just put your lips on the bong and suck. I'll pull the stem out and you'll get a nice hit. This is really good weed. I got it from a guy who's a DJ in Ibiza. That's like their Cancun over here. Ibiza. Cancun. Ryan felt so unsophisticated when Michael would mention these cosmopolitan locations. He reminded Ryan of his mom's old boyfriend, Ron, the coolest guy he'd ever met. Ron was the manager of the sunglasses hut at the Colonnade, at the Esplanade, at the shops at Winterhaven. Whatever happened to him, Ryan wondered as he coughed up a cloud of smoke. Dude, you are such a lightweight, Michael said. Ryan kept coughing, his eyes tearing up, and Michael patted him on the back. Ryan noticed that Michael left his hand there. It's just too harsh. Michael grabbed the bomb from him. I'll shotgun it for you. What's that? You'll see. Michael lit the bong and sucked on it, filling it with milky white smoke. Michael removed the stem and quickly suctioned all of it into his mouth. Michael leaned in towards Ryan. Come here, he said. Michael grabbed Ryan's Ed Hardy t-shirt and pulled him close. Open your mouth. Ryan did what he was told. Michael put his lips up to Ryan's and blew a tornado of marijuana smoke into his mouth. Ryan instantly felt a warmth and sweetness hit his pleasure centers. He also noticed they were both rock hard. They stared at each other, their lips an inch apart. Suddenly, Michael grabbed Ryan and threw him down on the bed. Ryan couldn't believe this was happening, but he was thrilled. They rolled around on top of each other, making out furiously. Ryan stopped. Dude, I'm not gay, he said. It's cool, bro. Me neither, Michael said. Michael said this as he pushed Ryan's head slowly down onto his engorged cock. No homo, Michael said, as he put his dick balls deep into Ryan's mouth. To Ryan, Michael's dick tasted of power, chlorine, and America. Ryan finally came up for air. Michael pulled Ryan up and rolled on top of him. Michael dragged his dick up and down along Ryan's shaved chest, letting the stubble graze his boner. Jesus! Yeah, Ryan said. Suddenly, there was a knock at the door. Ignore it, Ryan said. But Ryan was shocked when Michael said, come on in. Dude, are you crazy? Michael whispered, it's a surprise. A figure appeared in the doorway, backlit in the darkness. It was a man, Ryan thought. Or was it a machine? The man-machine's body was chiseled. His thighs were enormous. But the lower halves of his legs were... Ryan didn't know what. They looked like giant hooks. Is there room for one more? The man asked in a strange accent. Michael looked at Ryan, who surprised himself by nodding ever so slightly.
Sure, man, said Michael. The man stepped forward and Ryan instantly recognized him as championship runner Oscar Pistorius. Got your text, Michael. Perfect timing. I'm on my own tonight. Reva and I got in a fight. Women. Can't live with them. Can't kill them. Michael and Ryan looked at each other and gave an uncertain laugh. Oscar sat down on the bed. He removed the metal hook-like appendages from his lower legs, peeled off his running gear, and climbed on top of Ryan. He darted his tongue in and out of Ryan's mouth. Ryan wasn't sure he was into this, but all that changed when he looked over at Michael, who was stroking himself furiously. He realized he was the star of this trio, and it was a huge turn-on. His dick, already hard, became like concrete. Are you ready to take this to the next level? Oscar asked Ryan. Ryan nodded. He had no idea what this meant, but he didn't care. Yes to everything. He was all in. Oscar rolled over to the side of the bed. He grabbed his bag and pulled out a giant strap-on cock. Ryan had no idea why they would need an artificial dick when there were already three real ones in his bed. But he understood when Oscar lifted his leg and locked the strap-on into place on his right knee. Oscar greased it up with lube. It's time for you to take a ride on my championship thigh, he said. Ryan slowly lowered himself onto the giant dildo, gradually enveloping it into his ass. Oscar started lowering his leg a little and then thrusting upward, again and again. At first it was painful, unfamiliar, but then, holy fuck. Oh yeah, Ryan said. Jesus, he said. The euphoria was so intense, he could feel himself letting go of so much. Letting go of the melancholy he felt from years of sacrifice was dissipating more and more with each ecstatic thrust. Ryan kept alternating between saying, Jesus, and yeah. Jesus, yeah. Jesus, yeah. Then he accidentally combined the two and shouted, yeah! Yeah! To all the years spent underwater, exhausting himself in isolation. Yeah! To all the friendships that fall by the wayside because everything came second to winning. Yeah! To all the weird temporary father figures, coaches who knew only swimming and nothing else. Yeah! To finally winning big, being in this hotel room with two hot winners fucking each other's brains out, riding high above the world. That's when Ryan finally came. He jizzed all over Oscar's chest, just as Michael stroked himself into climax, coming on Oscar's face. Side note, Oscar couldn't come because he had no firearms with him, which he needed. Lying in bed, ready to pass out, Ryan realized he found his new catchphrase and knew that this would blow everyone's mind. Gia was his own personal own. He couldn't wait to unleash it on the world. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Steve Young. And your final round one competitor, Suna Bilstead.
My official name is Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571, but you can call me Tiny Airplane Charter for short. On the afternoon of October 13th, 1972, my aeronautical body was to fly a raucous rugby team across the Andes Mountains to play a match in neighboring Chile. There were four women, but more importantly, 41 bulging hot young men inside of me, and boy, was I happy. I am made of fabric, metal, and jet fuel, I know. But I can still appreciate the curvature of a man's ass. As it sits in my seats, I imagine his balls gently rubbing against his pants as he places them in my chairs. My two pilots, Julio and Dante, were very experienced, but something different was driving them that day, and it wasn't about driving me. See, they had been flying together for 5 years, and in that time had grown a love for each other so deep, so hard, that at times it was distracting for them to be so close in that tiny cockpit. Today was the day their unbridled passion would reach its breaking point. My undoing began simply with the undoing of their pants. The pulling and prodding of my levers got them both so hard, their cocks were throbbing behind their metal zippers like snakes, desperate to slither out of their polyester pant cages. Just a quick touch, Julio said to Dante, as Dante unzipped his dick, sprung out like a jack-in-the-box. They began slowly at first, softly stroking each other's full chubs with calloused hands, but it quickly became a furious game of who could spit their juice out first. I'm gonna come! No, I'm gonna come! Frantic, delirious, competitive. They lost sight of themselves. They lost sight of where they were going, what they were doing, and they both finally exploded their white-hot sperm cream all over my knobs. So did the right wing of my body as we flew directly into the top of a mountain. We hurtled further down, my ass split in half, taking with it six of my beautiful boys, violently ripping them out of me. Oh, how I wished I could have kept them all in me, curled safely in my steely bosom. My fuselage landed after a dramatic slide down a frozen white hill. As the remaining rugby players came to, they swiftly started tending to the wounded, removing the dead and placing them out in a snowy grave. Canessa and Zerbino, both medical students, would soon be tested on just how much they knew about the human anatomy. My rugby boys had no doubt they could survive the Andes Mountains, because for the past few years, they had already been enduring daily hand jobs from their coach, Andy. If they could survive Andy, they know they could survive the Andes. But as that first night fell, so did their morale. Cuddling up to each other, desperate to feel good, to feel some sense of hope, some warmth, some life force. It started off slow, just as any good orgy does. A hand slowly grazing the inside of a leg, a slight purposeful nudge of the hips. Will my touch be welcomed or shunned? With no words, no discussion, every man left in me knew what they had to do. The only way they could stay warm, the only way they could stay alive is to love each other in the deepest, hardest sense of the word. Antonio, the captain of the team, who always took a leadership role, pulled out his cock first. He ordered Ethan Hawke to touch it. Ethan Hawke liked to be bossed around and quickly obliged. It didn't take long before dicks and fingers and tongues were flying everywhere, flying around my little cabin like confetti. No one knew whose cock belonged to whom anymore, and it didn't matter. Streamers of cum flying through the air. You could have built a snowman with the amount of jizz that came out of all those dicks. When morning rose, their cocks rose with it. Cock-a-doodle-doo! This wasn't just a one-time orgy. As the passion that had been stirred within them that night was the very fire that would keep their hopes warm for the journey of survival they were about to embark. The next day was spent going through bags and collecting anything edible, toothpaste, wine, some chocolate. Days passed and their hunger grew. Their rations didn't last long, but their boners did. The only protein the men were getting was from the deep recesses of one another's ball sacks. But blowing all those loads was starting to take the wind out of their sails. They were feeding each other like birds. Spitting their semen in each other's mouths. But giver would grow weaker as taker would grow strong. Antonio and Ethan Hawke started a blowjob chart to make sure everyone was eating equally. Canessa and Delgado had started disobeying the rules and wasting precious cum by sneaking into the cockpit. They were sneaking each other's cocks into the pits of their assholes and losing their life-saving juice in the process. Javier, who had lost his wife, still refused to eat. He was getting sucked on daily, providing all of his salty goodness to the others, but would not eat himself. He still his dead wife. And gagged when penises touched his tongue. See, he had been secretly fucking his wife's dead body in the cockpit. When everyone thought he was out grabbing a smoke, he was instead out grabbing the decaying breasts of his once lovely wife. Ethan Hawke yelled at him, "Forget your wife! Will you eat? Do it for your living children!" He pulled down his pants and jammed his hard cock deep into Javier's throat. Javier exclaimed, I will do it for my children. Like a baby suckling on his first pull of breast milk, Javier sucked so hard, so good, Ethan Hawke exploded faster than he ever knew possible. But on day 12, with no rescue plane in sight, they had to find more food. Ethan Hawke called a meeting and insisted it was time to start eating the meat off of their dead friends. But they were law-abiding Catholics, and the concept of eating their dead friends was overwhelming. No, we can't. What will God think? We can't. That would make us cannibals. Ethan Hawke took a pregnant pause, then confidently spoke. But I've been eating your dick for 12 days. Why not eat a piece of that guy's ass? And so it began. The lines between eating live flesh and dead flesh became blurred. Their sanity blurred with it as days and nights were spent swallowing the frozen meat of their dead friends, along with the hot, throbbing meat of their living friends. How were they to explain to the world that the majestic Andes Mountains had turned them into homosexual cannibals? It was too much to bear. Knessa and Ethan Hawke decided it was time to embark on a rescue mission. Just like they had climbed the mountains of each other's tight, hot bodies, they would climb the mountains for Chile, to freedom. After a harrowing 9 days, they made it to the lush and moist green valleys of Chile. They both knew it was the last time they would be able to truly love each other in peace. So before they sought help, they fucked one last time. But this time it was sweet. They lined one another's lips with their tongues like a highlighter. They let each other's cum fly into the wind, free to land where it wished. This time they didn't do it for sustenance. They did it for love. When the rescue helicopter arrived at the site of my dilapidated fuselage, it was met with exuberance, but also sadness. The remaining survivors had lived on the flesh of each other's bodies, alive and dead for so long, they were confused, devastated, really. Knowing that their mouths and assholes were no longer going to be able to rationalize ingesting the lifeblood of cock love. In gratitude, the first six men that boarded the rescue helicopter gave the pilots massages. They were clearly still oozing raw sexuality, because as their hands were getting deeper and deeper into the muscles of the pilots, the blood was rushing faster and faster to the pilots' groins. On Friday, December 22nd of 1972, the rescue mission of my crash body, Flight 571, truly became a happy ending.
So Bill said, we get all the round one competitors back to the stage. All right, so momentarily, you guys are going to be voting on the winner. First, I'm just going to remind you of what everybody read. We started with John Toll with Cheers, Mo Welch with Kim Davis, Stephen Young with the London 2012 Athletes, and Suna Bilstead with Alive. So pick a favorite with your applause, starting with John Toll, Cheers. Yeah! Mo Welch, Kim Davis. Steve Young, London Olympians. And Suna Bilstead with Alive. I think that's Mr. Steve Young, your round one champion. Let him hear it. Thanks, everybody. Great job.
That does it for round one. To hear round two, you can download episode 150 next week. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. And for details on upcoming shows, you can follow me on Twitter at Brian Cooking or the show at CE Fanfic. See you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.